white people can be exhausting. That's the first line of my guest Austin Channing Brown's book, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. I'm Linda Sievertson, and I knew I would love her the second I read that line because I believe white people are exhausting. I've seen myself be exhausting over and over every time I've ever tried to connect with a black woman by asking about her hair or going on and on nervously due to guilt over my own damn white privilege. I shake my head and I laugh at myself because I know my heart and I know it's well-intentioned. But I still know I've got a lot to learn, and I have been so excited to get to know this author. Austin is one of the It Girl writers right now, and for good reason. She's a seasoned racial justice leader and has, with I'm Still Here, written what's been called a stunning debut and a book that's been heralded as devastatingly beautiful and haunting. Glennon Doyle calls her a master memoirist. Brené Brown is a big fan. In a minute, you'll hear why when I do something new in this intro and have Austin read a few graphs from her book, from a chapter I adore called Why I Love Being a Black Girl. But first, another new twist for this episode. As you know, if you've been listening for a while, our guest co-hosts, when I have them, are former guests themselves, but not today. Today, I have the great pleasure of making a new friend through Austin who recommended that her good buddy, Daniel Mallory Ortberg, join us. And what an amazing talent he is. Daniel is the New York Times bestselling author of Texts from Jane Eyre and Other Conversations with Your Favorite Literary Characters. Elizabeth Gilbert blurbed it with this little compliment to Daniel's publisher. Please send me 27 cases of Texts from Jane Eyre because I ate it like it was candy coated in crack cocaine. Danny has a new book out called The Merry Spinster Tales of Everyday Horror, which is a collection of brilliant short stories based on fairy tales. You may know Daniel as the co-founder and head writer of the now defunct online site The Toast, or as the oh-so-wise feminist voice, both in print and on the podcast of Slate's Dear Prudence, where Daniel's wise, funny, and soulful weekly advice is syndicated in over 200 newspapers. I might add that Danny is currently in transition from Mallory to Daniel, so his voice is changing and finding its natural pitch, which I think makes him all the more lovable and inspiring. In a world where we're all striving to be authentically who we are while hoping to experience dignity, I am so grateful these two have opted to join me here to help raise my game and our collective vision. Oh, and you guys, they are about to share some seriously great writing tips. So get your notepads ready. Okay, enough from me. Austin, tell us why you love being a black girl. Welcome.
When my body stands out and I am tempted to forget my own beauty, I close my eyes and remember the feel of my father's fingers against my scalp, braiding each perfectly parted row while telling me I am not tender-headed, so stop squirming. There was the cooling sensation of blue magic and pink lotion and the smell of hot curling irons as I learned about all the special things my hair can do. Natural or relaxed, braided or dreaded, twisted or knotted, cornrowed or weaved, our hair believes in being free to do what she wants. When I rub cocoa butter into my skin, I remember the warmth of my mother's hands when she used to tell me to get all the hidden spots behind my ankles and around my knees. The memories of her care for my body are a reminder of the care my body deserves. Black women are the backbone and muscle of every church I've attended. They are prophets speaking a word when it seems God is silent. They are hospitality, welcoming with food and kindness, with a seat at the table, with a place you can call home. We are capable of building community anywhere, not just at church or at work, but also in the quote-unquote ethnic hair care section of stores, in elevators, and other random places where we take the opportunity to simply say, I see you. I love being a black woman because we are demanding. We demand the right to live as fully human. We demand access, the right to vote, to education, to employment, to housing, to equal treatment under the law. And we do it creatively. Sit-ins and die-ins, signs and songs, writing and filmmaking. We demand because our ancestors did. We demand because we believe in our own dignity.
Austin, you know you are one of my favorite people ever since Glenn and Doyle introduced us by email a few months ago.
Oh my goodness. Glennon is one of my favorite people. It's so nice when you like see someone on the internet and then they're actually as kind as they seem.
I know. It's so true.
Right? Like it is the best thing ever.
Yeah. She's been a real angel in my life and an angel on the show and just a dream creator. It was magical for me. Here I was when Glennon's email came through connecting you and me. And I'm sitting in bed in a dark hotel room in Carmel. I think it was like 6 a.m. I'm about ready to get up for a long day of teaching a writing retreat. And despite not having 1 minute to read while I'm there, I don't know what got into me. I brought your book with me. It was literally in bed with me. So I don't think I've ever had more fun taking a screenshot than the one I sent you and Glennon with the book on my pillow going, dude, look, you're in bed with me right now.
Yeah, I think I replied with something like, I'm so honored to already be in the bed with you.
I know.
I'm glad we've already made it that far in our relationship. That's amazing. Yeah. Maybe all relationships should start like that. I don't know.
I know, right?
It's worked for us anyway.
Yeah. It was pretty magical for me to know that somebody I respect and admire as much as you and was falling in love with from a writing standpoint was, I mean, you turned around and said that you were aware of the podcast. The podcast had helped you. I couldn't believe it. That was one of those moments where you just go, is this real? Is this really happening to me?
Oh my gosh, it's absolutely true. So I have a tendency to only listen to podcasts when I'm traveling, like when I'm on a plane. But when I do, they're almost always about writing or creativity, every now and again, just like some pop culture fun. But I found yours because you had interviewed Terry McMillan.
Oh.
And oh my gosh, who's amazing, yes?
Oh my gosh. She's turned out to be
She's like my queen.
A dear friend now, and I feel so lucky to be in her orbit at all.
Oh my goodness. She's like the queen of black girl authors. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Queen. And so, yeah, that was the first time that I heard because it can be really hard to find authors of color who are being interviewed and who are talking about their craft and who are being asked about the writing process. And you did that. And so it quickly became one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for that. And then you have graced my life by introducing me to your friend, the amazing writer in person, Daniel Mallory Ortberg, who is now one of my latest obsessions.
I heart Danny so hard. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that he considers me a friend because otherwise I would just be that like weird fan that just won't leave him alone, you know? I'm so glad he hasn't gotten rid of me.
Yeah, no, I so get it. And for the show format, we're going a bit backwards here. I normally bring on the guest co-host first and we get connected and then we bring on our guests. But, you know, I like to mix it up a little bit. Daniel, are you there? I know you are.
Yeah, I am here.
Hey, thank you for coming on.
Hi, Danny.
Hi, guys. That was just so sweet and so charming. And thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, as you both know, our listeners are big writing enthusiasts. And before we get to talking about Austin's I'm Still Here and your latest, Daniel, I would love, love, love to get to some intel that helps our listeners shortcut their process from idea to done. To you both, but starting with Austin, were there any favorite writing books that you read early on that helped give you confidence in style or structure, the so-called rules of writing?
I did. I have three amazing books that I loved.
Oh, yeah.
One is The Elements of Story, Field Notes on Nonfiction Writing, which was really important to me because even though I was writing nonfiction, I wanted it to feel like fiction. Like I wanted to feel like people were there watching these stories unfold. And then the other two, Several Short Sentences About Writing.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. I feel like it's a pretty good mix of inspiration, but also get your butt in a chair and do this thing.
Yeah.
And it really is several short sentences, which makes it a really nice read because it's like reading a Twitter post on writing. Literally.
Oh, how cool. Now, do you remember the author's name on that one?
Verlin, I'm going to destroy the last name, Klinkenbord.
That's a hard last name. Our listeners will find it.
Yeah, how about several short sentences about writing. So good.
Oh, no, and you said there were three. Do you have another?
There's three. One more. The Elements of Eloquence.
Ooh.
By Mark Forsyth. It's so divine.
Okay. I haven't heard of that one either. Daniel,
I've got to check them out.
Any writing books that help your early process, Bibles of the Field, anything fly here?
First of all, just thank you for the phrase Bibles of the Field. That's beautiful. you know, I have not read a ton of books on writing. I think probably in high school, like everybody else, I read Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott.
Of course.
And King's on writing. But they were not especially formative for me. And I'm pretty sure that's the last time I ever read a book about writing, and that was probably about 13 years ago.
You know why?
So, wow. No.
I'll tell you why. Because you were so busy writing. I mean, when you get into your prolificness, it's astounding. Like 1,300 pieces you wrote for The Toast in the first 2.5 years. I mean, insane amount of output, not to mention
you
your
say
other
first
stuff.
2.5 years, but we only lasted for 3 years. So thank you for making it sound like that was just like the beginning as opposed to like, well, then we were winding down. I absolutely don't mean in any way to suggest that I think books about writing aren't helpful or a good idea. That hasn't really been part of my process. Yeah. And I think mostly reading a lot of fiction has influenced the way that I write, even when I do write nonfiction, which a lot of my pieces for The Toast were nonfiction. So that's probably where I got most of my writing advice, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in that same vein, to both of you again, what's your best piece of advice on craft? Something maybe that someone told you early on or something you read, but that you think about as you write still to this day. Like for me, it's no cliches. I know when I spoke with Nell Scavell, it was the same thing for her. No cliches. Just get rid of them. Get rid of them. So I'm always thinking about that. I'm also always thinking about getting rid of filler words. That's so very pretty. All those words that really add fluff, but not a lot of meaning. How about for you guys?
Danny, do you want to go first? I'm thinking about mine.
I would love to. This is like when you're at a big group dinner and no one's actually been looking at the menu and it's like, are we ready to order? And it's like, yes, if the first person has a very complicated order and none of us pay attention.
That's awesome.
I do feel a little bit guilty just because I don't have a lot of rules in mind necessarily that I follow or that I've tried, but I don't want to make it sound like, gee whiz, I just showed up and started writing one day and everything worked out great. I think it's
my first book was a New York Times bestseller.
I guess maybe more, I have often, through trial and error, found things that have worked for me and things that haven't, but I haven't often gone through really extensive processes where I try to like remove a lot or add a lot or try to adhere to a particular format. But I will say that something that I have found really helpful throughout my writing career is kind of going through different writerly fixations and sort of attempting to not slavishly copy somebody else's style, but really write with a particular influence in mind.
Yeah.
And I've done that for like some of my favorite authors, Mary McCarthy, Barbara Pym, Robert Benchley, in a way that's been a really fun exercise, I guess. So that's something that I have often done. I do sometimes like filler words. I sometimes like not having them. I don't think I have a really hard and fast rule about that. I'm one of the people, like, I was an English major, but I don't know what grammar is. And so it's one of those things where if you told me to, like, identify a gerund, I'd be like, oh, I definitely know that's a word of some kind, and it means something, but I don't know what it is, and I could never... What did they have you do, diagram sentences? They never had us diagram sentences in school.
Oh, yes.
So I realize I'm very playing into this, like, aw shucks persona, and I don't want to do that entirely. So I'll let Austin say something and try to think of a better answer.
Well, before Austin says something, I think, Danny, having done some research on you since learning about your amazingness, you were such an obsessive reader as a kid. I mean, you are, like, the quintessential nerdish reader. You were reading everything. So my take on you is that you read so much that any and all lessons were completely just imbued into your system. Is that the right word? See, I'm not a great grammar person myself.
Certainly the most generous interpretation of my childhood, and I totally accept it. Yes, exactly. Let's do it. Let's call it that. And I do think, though, especially having grown up reading the Bible very closely, just because there's so many different literary forms in there, and it's been so widely influential in Western literature, that was a really, really useful strategy for somebody who wanted to write, was just becoming very familiar with all these different forms of poetry and dialogue and storytelling.
Nice. Austin, any advice?
I do. So I was like literally just trying to remember. Like, there were so many things during the editing process. Keep this in mind, Austin. But one of them that really stands out for me is being really concerned about how it sounds out loud.
Yes.
So just like writing it on the page was not enough for me. I read this book out loud probably 4 or 5 times, because how it sounds in people's heads matters to me as much as like how it looks on the page, you know? And I think part of that comes from just growing up in a Black church where it's not enough for it to just be written well. Like, it also needs to sound really appealing to the ear. And so that was super, super important to me.
I think you've absolutely done that. That's actually one of my practices as well. And it's exhausting to read your galleys or the blue lines when they come in from the publisher way ahead of publishing.
Yes.
And they send you these massive pages, right? They're just huge. They come in this huge box. And you sit there, I sit there on the floor of my office each time, and I read the whole manuscript out loud, as you just said, several times, which for me is painful because I've already done it, but it's usually gone
through the
copy editing stage at that point, and they always change stuff, right? And oftentimes
I disagree
with the copy editor. In fact, on my first book, I think my results of her edits got her fired because I found so many mistakes that she had added inadvertently. She was a freelance copy editor. She wasn't like in-house, but they hired some gal out in the world and she put her paw prints all over my manuscript, made a ton of errors of which I pointed out every single one, and she was let go. And we had to do it again. And it is exhausting. It's like 9, 10, 12 hours to read your manuscript out loud. But like you said, it makes it so much better. It's interesting that you said that, because when I was reading your book, Austin, I felt like you had done that. I could hear it because it's lyrical.
Oh, I'm so glad.
It's poetic. Yeah, it's obvious.
I'm really glad to hear that, because you're right. I feel like the danger of reading, if there is a danger of reading it so many times, is that I became bored with my own book.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so my editor was like, do not change this whole chapter. This is going to be new to someone else. I'm like, oh, that's so boring. I'm sure there's another way I could say this. I read it both forwards, and then I would read it backwards.
Yep.
To make sure that it sounded good. Yep.
Mm. All right, I love it. I actually have that same problem with speeches. God forbid they give you 6 months to write a keynote, and you're sitting there.
Oh, gosh.
And by a couple months in, you're so sick of it, I end up just changing the whole thing and then talk about it.
Yeah, I'm like, doesn't everybody know this now?
I've been saying it in my yard.
Of course, we all know this thing about keynotes. I have never given a keynote speech. That's amazing.
Oh, yes, you have. I watched you give a keynote for the Toast.
Where? When? What happened?
Oh, come on.
What happened?
It was a conference. It was your first ever talk, and you were like, I've never given a talk before. And it was freaking hilarious. It was stand-up comedy. The whole place was raucous.
That wasn't a keynote. They put that next to your name if it's the keynote.
Okay, first of all, it was so close to a keynote. You were like headlining your own conference. That's the same thing. And you had a PowerPoint.
I find myself increasingly suspicious of the kindness displayed towards me on this podcast, you guys.
No, you had a PowerPoint and you had bullets and you
had
it was all there.
All right, fair
that
enough.
Sounds
I have
like
given a PowerPoint presentation. That's true.
Okay, so Danny, when you were scripting that, did you get sick of it and change it over and over before we saw it?
No. So I still definitely have a little bit of that I'll do it all the night before approach, which is not usually because I don't care about the sort of work that I do or giving a public presentation. It's often because I just can't think of something as real until it's about 24 hours away, which makes my personal life as reliable as it sounds. So it was one of those things where it was like the night before, and I was like, oh, okay, this is really happening. This wasn't a hallucination.
Oh,
I can give it my full attention now. So I wrote it all one way through and then tried to time it and was like, oh, this is way too short. Well, it's tomorrow now. Let's just vamp when we get on stage.
That basically sounds like how I did all of my college essays.
Yeah, it was very stressful, and I don't recommend it as a strategy. It was way too short, and I ended up having to just add a lot in the moment, which I don't necessarily recommend. I don't do that as much now. I do generally at least give it a couple days beforehand and make sure that it's the amount of time they said it needs to be. So that's one way in which I've slightly improved as the person in the world. But I'm definitely not a meticulous. I suffer more from laziness than I do from that sort of perfection or really over, not over, even just like analyzing, just regular analyzing. And I could probably do with more of that. I tend to be like, and it's not that I'm like, oh, I'm so great. I know this is going to be fantastic. I'll often have this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach of like, oh, I'm not sufficiently prepared. Let's just see how that goes because I deserve to be in trouble all the time.
I think your voice is so like, crystal clear, Danny, that it's so much fun to just sit up there and watch you just be yourself. It's so fun.
I have been trying to reanalyze my approach to that this last year because I hate being in trouble more than anything else in the world. And yet I seem to frequently engineer situations where I think I might be about to get in trouble. And every time anyone says to me, hey, do you have a minute to talk? Or like, can I ask you a question? I'm just like, great, my life is about to end and this is how things should feel all the time. This is normal and the worst.
Guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah. Just keep me in the tank, guys. Just keep throwing apples at my head. That's how it should be all the time. So I personally use Google Docs to write everything. Everything. I write everything in Google Docs. I don't write anything anywhere else.
No.
So obviously there's a lot of room for improvement there. What do you guys use to keep your writing organized?
Oh my God, Austin, I have to interrupt. I can't, I'm like in total shock right now. Google Docs to me are so scary. I just last week figured out how to use them. I've been using them for years because Danielle Laporte and I, when we wrote this thing called Your Big Beautiful Book Plan, and she was sending me all these Google Docs. And so I would answer Google Docs and frequently get locked out. And I'm like, how do I get back in? I had no clue. And so just recently, I actually hired somebody to consult with me with shared screen over the phone to learn how to deal with my Google Docs. And now they're on my phone. They're on my computer. I'm so happy. It's the most miraculous thing, but never in a million years would I have trusted a book to them.
Wow. Congratulations on getting somewhere.
Wow. I mean, to me, it's Scrivener all the way. Do you guys know Scrivener? Literature and Life.
I do.
Scrivener?
Yeah.
Oh, holy moly.
I know
moly.
The book.
Yeah. You got to go check this out, Scrivener Online. It's like having a binder with all your different categories all on the computer, but it acts as a binder. So you know how if you're working on a Word doc and you've got, say, 300 pages of your manuscript and it's all in one doc, it can be really hard to find things. And when you add things, your page numbers get all screwed up and it's just crackers. So with me, I love Word, but I use Scrivener first. So on the left-hand side, I can see all my chapters. And I can click on any chapter and it all comes up instantly. And then I can compile it into a Word doc or a PDF in 1.2 seconds. And when I compile it, I don't have to include all the chapters. Let's say I want to read some of the chapters for edit, but I don't need, you know, chapters 20 through 30. I just need 1 through 19. And I just mark it and boom, my PDF or my Word doc then has exactly what I need.
That does sound better than my current strategy, which is just scroll through the whole Google Doc until I reach the page I need.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
That's
making.
So annoying.
You're going to be
so
happy.
That.
And especially because you write with so many different characters, Danny, Scrivener, you're going to freak out because there's a place to put. You can literally have hundreds of files on the left-hand side. You can have your research. You can have your proposal. Everything can be there, and you can see it all at a glance and know exactly where you are at all times.
Thanks. Stressful.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
I can't imagine being that together.
Okay, so Austin, what do you use?
Oh, I'm a total Scrivener user too. Yeah.
Are you?
So I start there. Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't compile it until I have to actually send it to someone else. And then after like the copywriting phase, then I'm just in Word the whole time. But oh, yeah, it's built on Scrivener for sure.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Okay, so for our listeners, if you haven't tried Scrivener before, I think there are a couple of copycats, so you definitely want to go to the one that says Literature and Latte. It's for Mac, it's for Iowa, it's for everything. But it's also kind of complicated at first, and they have all sorts of tutorial videos. Guys, I get nothing. It's not like I get any kickbacks for recommending this. I also love Evernote. I also love Trello for different reasons, but Scrivener's my favorite. But anyway, if you need support, I actually hired somebody. I've been using Scrivener for years, but didn't know how to compile.
And so I just hired somebody. I went online and I looked up Scrivener experts, found a gal who wrote the Scrivener for Dummies. Her name is Gwen Hernandez. So GwenHernandez.com, you guys can hire her like I did. I spent an hour with her and now I feel like a little expert. Anyway, it was the best hour I ever spent on tech support. GwenHernandez.com. Again, I don't get a kickback. I'm just happy to help you guys because it's life-changing. Okay, forgive me, but I got to get bratty for a few minutes. Let's start with Austin. Any haters in your creative life? I know you had serious dream killers in elementary school. I'm supposing that made learning a lot harder probably, but anybody in particular where it came to your creative efforts where you've had to sort of learn to banish those voices in your head?
You know, I'm not sure that anything came from a particular person as much as I'm just not sure I ever sincerely entertained the idea that I could be a writer, like for real.
Mm.
I think as a Black young woman trying to figure out what you're going to do in the world, I'm going to be a writer is not the first thing that came to mind for me. That's how I'm going to pay bills. So I went to business marketing. I have a business marketing degree. I guess I've always loved writing. Every English teacher I ever had was super supportive of it. I was helping other kids diagram sentences, Danny. I just want you to know if you ever need help with that, I got you.
Honestly, I might take you up on that.
So I always loved English, but I never had anyone come up to me and say, you should really think about this as a career. And so in some ways, I feel like I fell into it because there was definitely no path laid out that said, Austin, you could do this if you wanted to.
What did you start with? This couldn't have been your first.
I started with a blog.
That's right.
My little blog, yeah. She was my little friend. And then it turned out people actually read it, which was shocking. And it was an opportunity for me to clarify my voice and clarify who I wanted to be as a writer, what I wanted to talk about as a writer. So yeah, I'm really grateful for the little blog bubble that we had. It was good to me.
And how often did you blog?
Once a week.
Mm-hmm. And do you still?
No, I don't think I put up one post since writing the book. I just couldn't keep up with both. And I was pregnant. That's all I should think. I was writing the book, I was pregnant, and the blog was we're just going to hang on to you for a second.
Yeah.
Here are all the vintage posts, but there's nothing new on there. Yeah, and I'm thinking now about what to do with the blog, whether I'll change it up, do something different. Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of excited about what I'll try and do next with it.
Mm. And Danny, how did you start? Did you start with a blog?
No, I actually started out writing for a couple of websites when I was working in academic publishing. I wrote a bit for The Hairpin and The Awl, both of which are also now defunct. And then I wrote next for Gawker for about 6 months and another website called The Gloss. So I didn't have my own website until we started The Toast. I think I briefly tried to have a WordPress at some point in 2011,
yeah.
And that just did not work out for me. I just never updated it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about writing support groups for a second. I was in one at one point, and because I happened to be in one of the most competitive places on earth, Los Angeles, it was a little unsupportive at times. Have you guys ever been in writing groups, or do you prefer to be more of a lone wolf writer?
I used this wonderful social media platform called Facebook. that really became my friend. So I would create my own little support group. So we didn't necessarily write together or check in with each other, but they were people who were really supportive of the blog early on.
Nice.
And knew that I was trying to work out some ideas. And so I would shoot them ideas. I would ask them about titles. It was just a really good, I need the ideas of 8 people in my life right now. And they were always just sort of waiting there for me. And then the number of groups I had started to grow, which was nice because then I could ask different groups different questions.
Oh, that's cool. Were these private groups?
Yeah.
Were they private?
They are. Yep. All of them. Mm-hmm.
No kidding. And how did you know who to invite? It was people that were writing to about your blog, commenting. Is that it?
Sort of both. And, in this age of Twitter friends, it sort of becomes this combination of people in real life and writers that you admire and people that you're in conversation with, on one space and then you transfer to the other space. So, there's a group of people, some of whom I still haven't met in real life. And we've been on the same Facebook groups for 2 or 3 years at this point.
Oh, that's so nice. So your experience with groups then has been really, really supportive.
Well, when you get to choose it, you know.
Yeah, you kick those assholes out. See ya. And how about you, Danny? Groups? No groups?
No, it seems to me like my perception is that writing groups are often more for people who are working on books or longer pieces of fiction. And since I really came up writing a lot of very short humor pieces, it didn't quite work in the same way because it's a lot harder to assemble a group when it's like, this is due in 6 hours and will be forgotten in 8. So
read it now.
I've had a couple of close friends who, especially earlier on in my writing career, would often like hassle on GChat and say, like, do you think this joke is funny? Do you think that this is an interesting angle to write a piece about? And getting really, really helpful feedback. And then occasionally if they were working on something, I'd do the same. But it was always very informal, always one-on-one. And I usually probably only did that around, I don't know, 20 or 30% of the time. But I have found it really helpful. I really, really have. So while it hasn't been a formal group setting where we meet regularly and read and review each other's work, like in a really formalized setting, I have enjoyed getting feedback from people whose sense of humor and ways of thinking about the world I really trust and respect.
Yeah. I have a friend, she's a best-selling author, and she has a really kind of vulnerable but helpful process where before one of her books is due to her publisher, I think she's got 5 now, she will send the entire finished manuscript as tight and clean as she can get it, and she'll send it to literally 40 of us. She has a lot of friends.
Wow.
And she has a coaching business. So she, kind of like what you were talking about, Austin, she has a really strong network of people who she trusts, who love her work,
right,
who are helpful and genuine. And she'll email it to 40 of us. And not all of us can read it at the time. Sometimes these things come in and when you're on deadline, you're like, oh, sorry, good luck. And other times you've got the time. And even if we only read 2 chapters, we're going to catch stuff and we're going to say, hey, but did you think about this or that? And so once she goes through the feedback of 40 of us, I'm telling you, those manuscripts are so much better. So if you can handle a lot of cooks in your kitchen, and if you're strong enough in your voice and in your confidence, and you're not willy-nilly and you're just going to change stuff just because one person said, that can be a really cool way to do things too. Crazy making, but it can be great. Okay, so I want to talk about getting agents. I want to know, did the two of you write proposals? Danny, your text from Jane Eyre, your first book, how did you get your agent? And did you write a proposal?
I did, yeah. So at the time I was writing that series on the Hairpin, which was a wonderful, wonderful site that at the time was run by Edith Zimmerman, who's just an absolute genius and probably one of the most influential writers I've ever encountered in terms of how I developed my own voice. And it was the kind of website that it did not have millions and millions of visitors every day. People who read it at that time either worked in publishing or media in some form. So yeah, it was one of those places where if you wrote something there, generally speaking, somebody would notice who, if you were interested in writing a book, could probably help you out with that, which was remarkably convenient for me.
So an agent approached you.
Yeah. So the second or third time I did the text from a literary character piece, which again, it really like, it fit in with a lot of things that book people already really like. It followed a very classical, white dominated liberal arts education stuff. So it was like, hey, you remember these books?
So
it was already very much like up their alley to begin with. So demographically speaking, I was really well situated. And so by the time I wrote the second or third one, a handful of agents had emailed me saying, hey, did you ever, you know, there was still kind of a Tumblr to book pipeline left at this point. So everyone was very much like, hey, sometimes people make jokes online and we can turn that into a book. So I was able to catch that wave. And so Kate McKean, who's my agent still, was one of the first agents to email me, and I liked her the most. So I wrote her back and I wrote a proposal. She was really, really helpful. And I thought like, wait, I'll have a book in 6 months. And that's not what happened. She wasn't able to sell it. Nobody wanted it. It was sort of like, we really like this idea, but does it have to be text? And does it have to be about literary characters? Have you ever thought about writing a YA novel? And at that point, it was like, no, I haven't. Thank you, though. So we let that one go. And then about a year later, Nicole and I had started The Toast. And I was really like, well, I run this website now, so I'm going to bring this dumb series back because I love it and no one can tell me not to. And we were able to kind of establish it as something that could be popular on various platforms and over a long period of time. And at that point, Kate said, hey, I think we could probably try to sell it now.
A year
after that was when we sent it back out and then got some interest and were able to sell the proposal.
Oh, that's so good. That reminds me of this time my agent was sending out my proposal all over the place. It was for a book of interviews called Lives Charmed, and this was like 1996, I think. And, you know, I'm getting tons of rejections, and I get this one rejection letter that was so painful. It said, yeah, we really like the author, and we'd love to see other things from her, but we're thinking that this, you know, they didn't say this part, but this 400-page manuscript we've got on our desk might be better as a magazine article. And I'm thinking, oh, no problem.
Whoa.
I'll do a little cutting.
Jeez.
Can you imagine? Like, thanks, 100,000 words. I'll just trim that to 2,000. No problem.
Wow. And did you turn it into a magazine article?
Hell no. I waited until I pulled it. I pulled it kind of like what you were talking about. I pulled it, even though my agent was still really enthusiastic. God bless him. And I reworked it. I took a year and I reworked it. And basically what I needed to do was I needed to get bigger celebrities, because in those days, well, still, it's based on how big is everybody's platform, right? So at the time, they needed bigger names. So I went off and I got bigger names. And while I was doing that, I really made the proposal tighter. I hired a copy editor to teach me how to edit better, as well as those books that I was reading at home on my own, which was Elements of Style, the Chicago Manual of Style. And then when we sent it back out, the house that ended up buying it gave it a unanimous vote. I think it was like 25 people voted on it, and just showed me that you just stay with something, right? You don't give up. You just keep going until you get the desired outcome.
Or you can totally give up, and that's fine too.
That's absolutely fine. If you want to give up, but if you don't want to, it sucks. Okay, so Austin,
right,
no. I want to hear about your book deal for this one. Did you have an agent?
Yeah.
Did you write a proposal? What did that look like?
Oh, my story is very similar to the two of you. So I wanted to write this book years and years and years ago, and I was just sort of pitching it. I didn't have like a fully written proposal, and then I had a couple, like I still had like a baby blog, and so there were a couple editors here and there who were like, maybe this could be a thing. And so I sort of pitched the idea for the book, and they were like, so you want to write a book about white people touching your hair? Interesting. It's right, like, is that the whole memoir? Were you climbing a mountain while they tried to touch your hair? Did you, like, what else happened?
Yeah.
It was very quickly rejected. We're like, no, this is not what a memoir is, friend. And so I put it away and for years just continued to work on the blog and focus on the blog, and really just life conspired, to be honest. I wish I could say that I was persevering or something. The truth is Black Lives Matter happened, and Ta-Nehisi Coates happened, Between the World and Me happened, Roxane Gay happened.
Citizen happened.
Like, the world just changed.
Yeah.
Exactly. Ugh. And so as my blog gained popularity in that era, then people, publishers started contacting me. And I went to Rachel Held Evans, and said, Rachel, these people are contacting me, and I have no idea what to say. I don't know what to ask. I don't know what I'm doing. Help me out. And so she let me borrow her agent, who's Rochelle Gardner, and Rochelle has been with me ever since. And then she and I spent 2 years working on a proposal.
Did you really? So she was a really hands-on agent.
2 years. Oh, my goodness. I am so grateful. For one, Rochelle Gardner. I would probably still be writing a proposal if it wasn't for her. Listen. Like, I don't know what I'm doing.
When you said that, I was like, oh, sister, you are so much more important than you think you are. Oh, I love it. I love
it's
a hands-on
just, it really
agent.
It's just all so new to me, you know, whole publishing process, the writing process. I've only seen Black women do this from afar, never up close. And so I really relied on a lot of folks who were generous with information and advice.
Yeah. You know, when Stephen Pressfield was on the show, he talked about stealing, you know, form and structure from famous literature and making it your own. And we all know the story about Shakespeare famously stealing the structure of Romeo and Juliet. But Daniel, I was thinking as I was reading your work, I was like, oh my God, this is the perfect example of what Stephen was talking about. Taking something from literature and making it your own. Do you have anything to say on that? Because I love it.
I mean, I have thank you to say about that, certainly. That means a lot.
Yeah, I think that that's always been something that I have done a lot. It has always felt really second nature to me to mostly just riff on things that I'm already really familiar with. And for me, the challenge is always, I don't want the joke or the thought to simply be like, hey, remember this? Or like, what if books, but with phones?
Yeah.
To make the joke simply, hey, you've heard of this thing. Now imagine this second thing. I put these two things together. So
right. The
thing that's always interested me is to figure out how to avoid falling into the laziest version of the thing that I love doing. And I think that that's often true for all writers, is there's sort of the best possible version of our shtick, and then there's the sort of shadow version of our shtick, and it's sort of a constant balancing act to try to make sure that we're doing not the other.
I love that. I'm interested, Austin, in your perspective on being a people of color writer. I guess you say POC.
Yeah.
One of my favorite chapters, which we will talk about, is White People Are Exhausting, which is brilliant, and I know we are, and I see myself being exhausting, hopefully a lot less lately now that I'm more familiar with what's exhausting and what isn't. But is being in a predominantly white book publishing world, is that exhausting too? I mean, does it feel harder to break in out of a writer first and a POC writer second?
So I have like 5 responses to this question. It's such a good question. The first thing that comes to mind is the publishing industry, particularly the Christian publishing industry, was definitely difficult. I'm really, really grateful for my publisher, but there was a lot of teaching that I had to do.
Oh.
So as we, for example, made our book trailer, and they were choosing images to try to go with the description of the book, and just nuances in those images of Black girls around white people, I bet we redid the images in that video probably 4 or 5 times before I was satisfied.
Wow.
Because there were things that they just didn't know, you know, as white folks. And so, and there were a few of those moments where I had to say, nope, that's not going to work. That's not okay. And I'm really glad that they were receptive and listened really well. I never feel like they pushed back on something I said that was, you know, a serious concern for me. So I'm grateful for that. But there was a lot of additional teaching. So I wasn't just writing. I was also constantly having to think about the lens of race, even as we thought about marketing the book. So that's the first thing. And then the second, this is really stupid because I'm really, really proud of the book, but it is sometimes really frustrating that people don't ask me more about writing, but that all they really want to talk about is race.
Really? Oh my God, I had to force myself not to ask you more writing questions because I have more.
Oh my gosh. And I think it's because I really do love the craft of writing. You know, I realized that I wrote a book on race and don't expect people to ask questions about race. That's great. Yeah. That is not a problem for me. But I don't mean that as a complaint, but I think because I'm a person of color, people have a tendency to not really think about the fact that I wrote the book.
Right.
You know, yeah, but definitely being an author of color has its quirks for sure.
Yeah.
Austin, as you say, there's that sort of balancing act to be struck between you want to write about race and racism and you want to address that in your work. But then there's also that request or inherent request that can come from like a majority white publishing environment that's sort of like, you are of interest to us in your capacity to narrate Black suffering. So as long as you're willing to do that, we will celebrate, tokenize, praise you. And if you dare to do something else or add to that or to want to talk about other parts of your life that don't center our assumptions about the nature of Black suffering, it's too niche, it's too weird, it doesn't fit the great tone of your first book. Does that make sense? Does that sound accurate?
Absolutely. And the truth is, so I'm already thinking about what the second book will be, and I have no idea, except that I wanted to celebrate Blackness and kind of ignore that white people exist altogether. And I'm really nervous that no one will like it. Like even, I mean, that no publisher will want it. And I honestly don't know what it's going to look like to shop around the second one. I hope that people will be into it and recognize that we are living in a different moment. But I am curious, Danny, to see how people react to me not telling a sad story.
I think what's really beautiful about the Black community is their ability to celebrate life. That's what I would want to read about.
That is so interesting, too, because I think one of the things, Austin, that I really value about your book is that it centers Black womanhood. And there's so many different ways, I think, in which
Blackness can be celebrated in certain forms of men that are not usually Black women in this sort
of way
that you are writing about, and that is really important to pay attention to. Who's the person getting celebrated? What are the ways in which Blackness is sometimes packaged or made acceptable? And what are the ways in which it gets rejected or rendered unacceptable?
Mm-hmm.
And what are ways that we can think differently about that? Does that make sense, Austin?
It absolutely does. And it was a huge part of my agreement with myself as I wrote this book, that I refused for it to be only trauma. Mm. That's unacceptable, because it's only half the story. The other half is about joy and celebration and laughter and art and music and community. And our community is so rich. And to only tell half the story felt like it would be a slap in the face to the community I love.
And I love
and so
learning
I'm so
about,
glad for those who pick up on it.
Oh, I loved learning about when you switched from, you know, you were raised in a white community, and then when you started to go into the Black community and really learn about Blackness, at first you felt like a fish out of water, right? You were too white for the Black kids.
I was
kids.
Terrified.
You were too Black for the white kids, so you never felt like you fit in. But then you go into this world and you're learning about Black beauty and culture and all of the things we just talked about. And it was wonderful the way you started to slip into it and how it changed you, and culminating in the church where finally Jesus was Black.
Right. You know, it's so funny how easy it is to take things for granted. I mean, I was in a white school with white teachers, and I just swallowed the expectations around quietness and politeness. And then to be in a Black space that has completely different cultural rules.
Right.
Was scary at first, but ended up feeling so much more natural once I figured out that I didn't have to do everything the other kids did, but that I could embrace things that did feel natural for me. And it really did. It changed my world.
Mm, so beautiful. So yes, I want to see a book on celebrating Blackness. Go for it.
Mm, that'll be the next one. We've all decided.
We have done it here on the Beautiful Writers Podcast. All right, so Danny, this actually brings up, I think, a really good point for you, which is here you are in transition going from a white feminist woman, a white female feminist.
Yeah, I'm not transitioning away from feminism, so that's not like,
yeah. Oopsie, didn't mean to say it that way. But it's pretty interesting, like what a kind of head scratcher. You've been a feminist your whole life, a female, white female, and now you're a white male feminist. So do you ever kind of marvel at the unexpectedness of this new part of your life?
It's certainly, you know, something that comes up when people, especially in the trans community, discuss transition. I think sometimes there's this idea that somebody's gender identity is about something other than something that is innately and deeply felt. So because somebody who's transitioning from female to male, depending on a number of factors, including whether or not they pass, which is sort of like a concept that carries a lot of its own weight, there's this sort of question of how do you deal with the real world effects of no longer going through life being treated like a woman, but being treated like a man. And that changes a lot depending on also your race, your socioeconomic status, whether or not you get read as heterosexual or not. So of course, there's often for different people a gaining of male privilege in a way that's real and meaningful and needs to be grappled with. But I do think one thing that's important to bear in mind when we think about those things is gender identity is really, it's deeply felt, and it's not as a result of someone sitting down and thinking, what would make my life easier or better?
Yeah.
So, of course, that thought occurred to me and distressed me as I was grappling with my own transness and thinking about, could I ever tell my family? Could I ever tell the people in my life? Could I ever actually transition? What would people say? Isn't this embarrassing? But there was never a sense of, oh, gosh, to get out of Dodge, or time to make my life easier, or I should feel responsible for the results of patriarchy and sexism in the world on the basis of my personal gender identity. So in that sense, I do think it's sometimes a useful question to step back from. But when it comes to real world implications in terms of how we get treated, how we can help others, ways in which trans men are deeply in need of and full participants in feminist action. That, I think, is so important and absolutely crucial to grapple with.
Mm.
But absolutely. There were days when I would just sit at home and just be like, really? Really? and I had to find a lot of community and support and think of, how do I understand my vocation as a gendered person
which I think is also the way I find most helpful to think about my own transness, in a way that is not simply, I have to do something that I think is a bad idea because to do otherwise, I would be closeted for the rest of my life. Like, I could not simply think of transition in that sense. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. I have a membership site for writers called the Beautiful Writers Group, and I recently had an expert on. His name is Sean Pratt, and he has recorded 1,000 audiobooks. He's one of the biggest audio narrators in the business, and he talks about how exhausting it is. You're learning a new muscle.
That's
you're building new muscle when you're narrating a whole book. I wanted to ask you, you know, some authors don't get asked to narrate their books. Others do and choose not to. Austin, I love how you narrated your book. Your voice is so calm and soothing and beautiful, and it just worked perfectly with your book. I know that, Daniel, you have not narrated your two books. So despite the fact, Daniel, that your voice is the voice of Dear Prudence for Slate on their podcast, you have a stunning voice, also sort of velvety, like Austin. So I really want to talk about,
ooh,
you know,
velvety. I like that.
Velvety. Something both of you, like, talk to me about narrating. Austin, tell me what happened.
Sorry, I'm totally having a moment with Danny. I knew that I had to narrate my own book, mostly because of what we talked about earlier, because the way it sounds means so much to me. And so it's really my desire for control over how the book sounds.
I get it.
But it was a lot of work. And I tell you, especially because as I was narrating, I spend most of my days home with my son, who's like 9 months old or so at the time.
Oh, goodness.
And so the most I would say during a day is like, are you ready for a bottle? Do you need to be changed? How you doing, bud? Like, that's the most my vocal cords got. Yeah. And so to go from that to reading for hours out loud, my vocal cords were like, what is happening here? So it was a lot of work. It was really hard. But I'm really glad I did it, for sure.
Oh,
no regrets.
It's beautiful. What kind of a microphone did you use?
Oh, I have no idea. I went to a little studio. They had everything set up. They said, all you have to do is talk right here. And I said, okay.
Oh, okay. Because when you said you were at home, I thought, oh, my God, she recorded it at home? What is she talking about?
Oh, no.
Yeah, that'd be impossible with the child.
On a regular basis.
Yeah. Got it. So, Daniel, why didn't you do your own audio?
I did a very simple answer to that. Nobody asked.
Seriously?
Yeah. Well, you know, my first book was, I was not an especially well-known person, and it's dialogue. It's mostly dialogue, so they really needed two people, so they hired some.
Oh, that's right. Because it's a performance, not a read, right? You don't read your book. You perform your book. So you had characters to be performed. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
The whole book's dialogue, which I realized on my first book tour as I was trying to do two voices as one person. And I'm going to turn that one around.
Yeah.
You know, now it's slightly different because, as you guys know, my voice is changing.
Yes.
Due to my transition. So sometimes when I do the podcast now for Dear Prudence, I'll feel a little self-conscious because my voice will jump around a little bit. So I don't think I'll be able to read a lot anytime soon, but maybe someday when my voice settles and it doesn't sound quite so absurd, I would enjoy doing that again, or for the first time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I love your voice on the podcast. So, but you know what? Once you go through the full transition, your voice is going to be dependable again. It's going to be
It's so strange, you know, like I'll hear myself singing along in the car and I'll realize like, oh, wow, there's this whole new range of notes that I have access to I didn't used to. And oh, boy, that note's gone. And it's really puts you in touch with your lack of control over the world around you sometimes. And it's kind of beautiful. And it's kind of weird. And, you know, I'm just in it.
Oh, yeah.
Austin, I loved how you were writing about learning to question what you call something that looks like unity at first glance. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that, if you're amenable.
Yeah. This was honestly an aha moment that I had as I was writing the book. You know, when you sit down to write, there's some things you know you want to say. And then there are other aha moments that come as you're writing.
Totally.
This was one of the ones I was like, ooh, that's what was happening. So I was thinking about this moment I had in high school with one of my favorite teachers. She was a religion teacher. And she was a nun, and we all loved her because she loved using four-letter words, which we thought was fantastic as she talked about the Bible. And so I remember we had gone through an entire semester with her, And then the semester changed, so we continued our class with her, but she had some new classes as well. And so we walked in at the beginning of the new semester, and she said, everyone sit wherever you want to. There is no more seating chart. And we all thought, okay, that sounds great. Then we sat down, and she said, I have a confession to make. I am racist.
No.
And we were like, okay,
where is this going?
And she started to explain that she realized she had been using her seating chart to make sure that students of color didn't sit together. And so at the semester change, she realized that there were two black girls sitting next to each other because she didn't realize those names were black. And her first thought when she saw the two of them sitting together was, oh no, they're going to be so disrespectful and so sassy. I'm not going to get anything done in this class. I can't believe. And like mid-thought, she was like, holy shit. I can't believe this is what I've been doing.
Mm.
And so it was really sparked for me.
Together, right?
Never, never. And if there were two white kids who were disrespectful, she never thought, oh, these white kids. I can't believe these white kids are so disrespectful, right?
Right.
So she decided that she was not going to use a seating chart in her class anymore. And as I thought about that story, like, why is that story so important to me? I began to realize it's because I love that teacher.
Yeah.
I thought she was fantastic. If anyone had walked up to me and asked me whether or not that teacher is ever racist, my answer would have been, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that she had some racial bias that she was acting on that only she knew about.
Yeah.
And it began to produce this question in my head, like, are there other teachers that I like, other teachers who may even like me, who I have to prove that I'm not sassy or I have to prove that I won't be disrespectful? Are there teachers who are grading me differently because I'm black? Are there other teachers using the seating chart, trying to make sure I don't sit next to someone who looks like me? So, yeah, it just raised a lot of questions for me that even though things appear to be harmonious, there could still be racial bias at play that I just am not aware of.
Well, I think that's the beauty of your book. The beauty of your book, the beauty of Citizen, the beauty of all of these books that are coming out right now about race is that we're starting to see the gradients, right? We're starting to see the nuances of racism.
People have written about this idea that everybody wants to be black, but nobody wants to be black. And
exactly,
this idea that
right.
Blackness is fun, it's desirable, it's cool, until it comes attached to a black person. And then it becomes something to be punished, managed, controlled. And so that's so useful. And I'm just thinking, Austin, of like you were saying about that teacher and how even ways in which when white people first start to reckon with our own racism, which often comes as a surprise to us, we can do it in ways that are additionally damaging with this sort of immediate, without thought of how it might affect the
right.
people of color around us, this sort of announcement of, I've discovered I'm racist. It's time for me to cleanse myself of sin. Without
right.
thinking, how might this, as you said, Austin, it made you feel uncomfortable. It made you feel singled out. It made you
yeah.
wonder about other teachers that you might have had. There was no
That's
sense
right.
of, is this information that is useful to the black students that I teach? Or is this
That's
something
right.
that I need to work through personally and do differently without making an announcement? And in that announcement, kind of implying, now that I'm going to do better, I need everyone to sort of forgive and congratulate me, right? We often want
right.
when we like wake up to, oh, wow, did I grow up in a sundown town? I had no idea. Oh, do I sometimes adopt AAVE in a sort of attempt to use blackness as a fun costume and then treat it differently when it comes from a black person? Gosh, now that I know about it, I'm just going to make a big casual announcement and expect everybody to be really jazzed. And like, if you are a black woman and you hear that from a lot of white people in your life all the time, that's exhausting.
It really is. And I tried really hard in this book. First of all, I knew that not all white people were going to read this book, right? Like you open up the first line and I expected there to be a lot of people in Barnes & Noble who put that book right back on the shelf. White people can be exhausting. That's the first line of the book.
And so, yeah. Which is a mild sentiment, by the way.
I loved it. I loved it because I instantly knew what you were talking about all the time.
You have to educate
people. And I think
people.
That's so true. I think it's so true, even for white people. Like when I am at a reading and I read that line, there are absolutely white people in the audience who laugh because you only need to be a part of race conversations for about 3 seconds before you realize how exhausting other white people can be. Or you yourself once was, you know? And so it was really important in this book to try to give that level of nuance so that those who want to be transformed can see themselves. And not everybody wants to see themselves, but for those who are interested, for those who want to be set free and want to be a good friend and a good ally and a good lover and a good parent to the people of color in their lives, this is just my offering to say, this is how it feels when you recenter yourself over and over and over again in this conversation.
Well, before we go, I would love, Austin, if you could read just a bit from your letter to your son at the end of the book. It's so beautiful.
Oh, I'd be so happy to.
Yeah.
Though you are still being formed in my tummy, your father and I are slowly turning into parents, wondering more about your future than our own. While we delight in these conversations about who and what you'll become in life, we have been avoiding other conversations. We have avoided talking about the first time someone will call you a nigger. We have been avoiding talking about the first time you'll be pulled over by a cop because you look suspicious. We have been avoiding talking about the many assumptions people will have of you simply because God kissed your glorious skin and it blushed at the attention. We have avoided discussing how we will tell you about the world. Of course we will, but we don't like to think of it yet. We would rather wonder if you will be precocious or subdued, bold or shy, funny or serious, adventurous or introspective. We would rather wonder about your humanity than ruminate on the ways the world will try to take that away from you. They will first think you are beautiful, innocent, and you will be. But as your baby fat disappears and your height comes to match ours, they will start to see you as dangerous. But we will be here to refute the lies. We will be here to remind you that you are worthy of joy and love and adventure.
Mm. Oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you for reading that. Mm-hmm. Well, you two, you are both a force for good in this world. Talk about the power of the pen. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to know you both and to have been able to have this conversation. I hope we have many more.
Thank you so much
for the invitation.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this was great.
Thank you so much. This really was so good. It was so much fun to actually talk about writing.
All right. Love, love, love you guys.
Thanks so much for listening. If you're white and worry you might be exhausting, you got to get I'm Still Here because we got to do better, people. Plus, it's just a dang good read. If you're affiliated with a school, a nonprofit, or a religious organization and you'd like help practicing inclusion, Austin's workshops are infused with justice and pop culture and humor and truth-telling as she invites people to celebrate Blackness with her. You can find all of that, including her gorgeous blog posts, of which there are many, over at austinchanning.com. You can find Daniel Mallory Ortberg on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on slate.com. And I think you should hire him for a keynote with 24 hours notice. I heard you, Danny. Hey, I want to say a few words about sponsors. You may have noticed that I don't do outside advertising here. I fund this show all by myself, and it can get kind of expensive, actually. That said, this is my joy, a labor of total love. I've been approached by sponsors who have a wide reach and could bring us a lot of listeners, but that doesn't feel right yet. So for that reason, your 5-star reviews on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen are super appreciated because they help people find out about us. I do promote my own stuff here, and I have 2 spots left for my September writing retreat at La Playa Hotel in Carmel by the Sea. Bookmama.com is where you'll find all that info and testimonials, including one from the aforementioned Terry McMillan, who'd never paid to go on retreat before, but said she loved getting out of her loft and office to be in beauty, surrounded by other writers. The chapters Terry wrote there are crazy good, and I, like many of you, am anxiously waiting for that book to drop. Okay, peoples, you have some reading and writing to go do. I wish you many glorious hours of peaceful summer space, and maybe even some hammock time. Until next time, right on.